And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, a quick word about tomorrow's program. Baltimore City Mayor Catherine Pugh will be our guest for the hour. We'll talk about a wide range of pressing issues facing Charm City, from the opioid crisis and policing reform to education and homelessness. The mayor will take my questions and yours. Hope you can join us. Mayor Catherine Pugh will be here tomorrow on Midday. And now a kind of special Monday edition of Midday at the Movies, our monthly look at what's new and notable in Hollywood and throughout the film industry. We usually do that on Thursdays, but we've decided to talk about it today. Anne Hornaday is the film critic for The Washington Post. Jed Dietz is the founding director of the Maryland Film Festival. Welcome. Good to see you guys.
Thank you.
Good to be here.
And if you'd like to join our conversation, we're going to begin it by talking about Harvey Weinstein and the scandal involving sexual assault that is coursing through Hollywood. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. And our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. So, Anne, you wrote a very thoughtful piece in the Post a week or so ago about this. It was even quoted by a columnist in the New York Times. I guess Ross Douthat referred to it last Sunday. And you talk about the instinct in Hollywood to do what's called circle the talent. So what does that phrase mean, and has it in fact played out in this particular instance of Harvey Weinstein?
Well, I think I was getting at, and this isn't just in Hollywood, by the way, but this is kind of a great embodiment of it, but it's this kind of mythologizing of the talent, which is that one person who is so special, so key to the success of the enterprise and the operation, that without him or her, the whole thing kind of goes asunder. And I think Harvey Weinstein had really built, he had self-mythologized and also, frankly, had accomplished a lot. I mean, he really did sort of change the face of, help change the face of independent film, and really created this business model that's centered around award season, that uses award season awareness as kind of an affordable way to market a movie for a studio, although he spent millions and millions to do it. But he really did kind of preserve a space for the kind of mid-range, adult-oriented dramas and comedies that we all like to see. And he did that by leveraging the Oscar campaign. And so his sort of genius, his ability to do that, combined with his kind of, at the height of his powers, being able to attract talent and anoint young talent. I mean, you know, I kept seeing that word anoint in all of these articles, especially, you know, these young women feeling that if they played their cards right, they would be literally anointed. And that's kind of that's the height at which it was at its most kind of fully expressed. So the tendency is to circle those people and protect them, because without them, the thinking goes, whatever that magic is, goes away. And I feel that part of the kind of either the blindness to what was going on or the willed ignorance of what was going on was connected to that.
So I would say it was more than willed ignorance. I mean, I agree with all of that and the tendency to circle the wagons around talent or your fellow congressman or wherever you are when, you know, scandal hits. But this is, I think, something a little different. I was around him multiple times. I know people who worked with him. I've witnessed it, and I've heard incredible stories about what a brutal guy he was to deal with. You know, that he reneged on deals, threw ashtrays at people in meetings. I was in a movie theater where he just exploded at people at one point.
These weren't sexual assault stuff.
Well, that's the point I'm getting to. I mean, those rumors or factual things, I don't know, maybe none of them were rumors, but they were all over Hollywood for years, from early on in his career. I never heard one thing about sexual assault about him. And that's unusual, because this other guy, James Toback, this director, and you could name other people, Polanski and other people who are in the news as a result of Bill Cosby, sexual assault, those rumors were floating around. So Harvey Weinstein was specifically okay with people talking about him being a monster in business, and although doing all the things Anne said, also putting people in very awkward positions on a business thing, you know, pulling back on contracts and making a director who'd made an offer to an actor have to call him back and say, oops, you know, we're not doing it. I mean, really harmful things. And yet spent huge amount of money and effort to do everything he could to suppress anything about the sexual assault. Well,
and he wasn't doing anything to suppress his reputation as
a bully,
a bully and a creepy guy to deal with in terms of business.
I mean,
that's what you're saying.
Well,
I would say almost the opposite. He was sort of reveled in
that. Well, that was part of his self-mythologizing. Yeah, I mean, that was the tradition of that kind of mogul, you know, and the whatever Jack Warner, Harry Cohn, you know, I mean, there's a long tradition of bad behavior in at that level. And even though ultimately that might be illegal, you know, some of those practices that he was engaging in on a business level, I don't think that they were as clearly illegal. I mean, that's why the reason we didn't hear is because all these people were forced to sign non-disclosure agreements.
Well, he spent millions. Rose McGowan and others have talked about, you know, she talked about almost getting this sort of ridiculous thing where she gets an offer of $1 million and her people are saying we maybe could get him to six and settle on three. And then she said, wait a minute, you know, this is the wrong emphasis here. But what's fascinating to me is the effort to cover all of that up in an industry in which promiscuity and sexual, bad behavior sexually is part of the history of movies. I mean, Zanuck, and I mean, you go back, I mean, there are lots of these stories. And even contemporaneously, there are people known, Toback for sure, that you stay away from.
So he was a guy, for example. Toback is an example of someone that you did hear the rumors of assaults and abhorrent behavior.
Yes, rampant. But
you never heard that about Harvey Weinstein.
Right.
Not assaults, but I do think, I mean, I didn't because I was never, I'm not in circles to be hearing that anyway as a critic. I'm usually not in those rooms to be hearing rumors like that. But I gather there had been rumors about his relationship with the actresses before, but they were consensual. They were thought to be consensual.
Yeah. I didn't even know those, but that does, I mean.
That, I think, had been circulating. Hmm. That's my understanding.
Yeah.
But I think the understanding had been that those were consensual and kind of deals with the devil in order for so-and-so to get ahead. Mm-hmm. And they were really kind of reflecting poorly on the women, you know? It's like, oh, she's like, you know, it's the old casting couch rumor. They were pretty malicious.
Yeah.
It's interesting to me because Weinstein, I mean, unlike James Toback, who is a director, he's considered, you know, he's a
writer and director.
So he's on the creative side. He's the, you know, like an ad agency has the people who sell the accounts and then the people who write the ads. And there's this, you know, mythology about the creative people in any industry, you know. So Weinstein is an executive. He's a movie producer. I mean, he controls the money. He's the money guy. But he's being lauded as this great creative genius. I mean, that's an interesting thing.
Yeah.
He seems to have sort of hopped the fence between creative people and money people. I mean, is that...
He was a showman. I mean, I think
Is that
that's,
normal, though? I mean,
no,
are there other people who have that same sort of creative reputation who are the money people?
Yeah, I would say, you know, David Geffen in his day, Scott Rudin. I mean, there are, yes, I would say.
Okay, so in Hollywood, maybe that's not so unusual.
Mm-hmm. No, but, I mean, again, I do think it was sort of self, he wanted it that way, you know, like he loved being thought of that way. And again, it's not entirely untrue. Like, I think he really did, you know, he was creative. He made some creative choices. You know, he was creative about the way that he marketed The Crying Game. You know, he did that whole "Don't Give Away the Ending" campaign. You know, at the time, that was
so.
Just,
remind us about that.
Well, there was this wonderful kind of whisper campaign around The Crying Game, which was just this little tiny indie movie. I don't know, 89, 88, something.
Hilary Swank.
No. It was Stephen Rea. It was Forrest Whitaker and Stephen Rea. It was a thriller, a British thriller by.
Oh, I'm thinking of a different movie.
Stephen Frears, right? Was it Frears? No, not, Neil Jordan.
That's it.
And it was just—it was a really well-crafted thriller, little tiny movie, an indie. And Harvey, I think it was probably always targeted to do modest business. But in his, you know, he kind of started this little word of mouth whisper campaign of like, don't you dare give away the ending, you know? I mean, it became this kind of cause. And it turned out you had to see this movie to see what this ending was that you can't give away. And it was brilliant. I mean, and it was creative.
Just as like, a Barnum and Bailey.
It was a Barnum and PT, exactly.
Marketing thing. Yep. Yeah.
But and he did that over and over again. I mean, Life is Beautiful, Il Postino, Shakespeare in Love. I mean, he took movies that could have easily disappeared and helped get them traction in the marketplace. But I would say more, I mean, that's a skill and an art to people who really know how to do that in a very tough industry. But I would say also his very, very good eye for talent is, you know, Kevin Smith, who he, you know, with Clerks at the beginning, Tarantino at the beginning. I mean, there are many examples, actors and directors and writers, that he really launched. So, I mean, the horrible side of that is, so this offer he could make to actresses that I could anoint you or help launch your career, you know, had some credibility. And it seems, you know, he, unfortunately, those are the good and the bad side of that coin.
This is not a guy who seems to have a lot of friends either. I mean, this is not a person who is well-liked. He might have been respected, but boy, mm-hmm. he just does not seem to be one of the more popular people
no.
in Hollywood, even the sexual assault allegations aside.
Oh, no, the bullying. I mean, I had heard for years from my friends in the exhibiting community, the theater owner. I mean, he treated people horribly on that end of things. He would renege, he would not. The Miramax and the Weinstein Company were notoriously late in paying anybody what they owed them. They would go on and on and on and on and protract it. I was just at the Middleburg Film Festival 2 weeks ago, and lots of L.A. people there, agents and producers, and just no one had a... I mean, they all were recounting their worst experiences of being bullied by him. And
I'll tell you an amazing story from here, though. We had a little movie that we showed at the Charles called Tadpole that came out. Gary Winnick, who has since passed away, but was his first thing directing. Sigourney Weaver, low budget, but charming film. The print that we showed here had been shipped in from Seattle, I think. And the sound sync wasn't quite right. Not many people in the audience noticed it. Gary Winnick, the director, was with us for the screening, was furious about this. He said they promised they'd never send that print out. And he said, take me to the print. And the guy in our operation took him upstairs in the Charles, and he destroyed this print. He took out a knife and destroyed the print. I saw Harvey Weinstein maybe 8 or 9 months later in a hotel in New York, and he had some connections to Baltimore. And anyway, I went over and said hello. And he said, Baltimore. He said, that's where Gary Winnick destroyed that print of Tadpole. Here's this guy
so
running
he kept
this...
up on it. Yeah.
It was sort of incredible.
So what does this mean for the Weinstein Company now? I mean, you know, I'm interested in things like Mark Halpern, a journalist mm-hmm. formerly of MSNBC, and prior to that at ABC, and it was some, horrible behavior that he apparently did in the 90s while he was working at ABC Television. Showtime has canceled his show. HBO has canceled plans to make a movie about the 2016 mm-hmm. election based on a book he was doing. MSNBC has fired him. Just, you know, they've stopped all relationship with him. So that kind of stuff is happening to people like him. Leon Wieseltier, another highly lauded and highly respected public intellectual, was going to start a magazine. That funding has now been withdrawn for
Amazon.
That.
Amazon.
The guy at mm-hmm. Amazon yeah. Studios. So what happens to this company now? I mean, Mr. Weinstein's future, you know, may include some criminal indictments, mm-hmm. but what happens to the company itself? I mean, is this something that that this company would be able to recover from?
I don't see it. I would defer to Jed on this because I think he's a more astute observer of the business end, but I don't see a way for them to come out of this.
I would agree.
So the company just goes away.
I think they changed the name. I mean, this is, the plane going down or something. This is so you change the name. If you have the wherewithal, and I have no idea what their capital structure is or anything, but I think, you get rid of the name. I mean, they're already doing it. They're taking their name off of films that are coming out right now.
Or I mean, we're talking about Oscar season now.
Exactly.
Is Oscar?
Right.
Are there Weinstein movies in the pipeline?
Well, there's one called Wind River that we actually had talked a lot about this past summer. It was an excellent movie with Jeremy Renner and Elizabeth Olsen, ironically about sexual assault on Native American reservations.
Right.
And it, when screeners go out, and that'll be an awards contender, they would hope. I don't know that it would be a serious one, but, you know, I think it has, like, it certainly deserves to be in the mentioning.
Yep.
And they've apparently taken their name off those screeners.
Kevin Spacey, just this morning, at least that's when I read it. It might have come out last night.
I think it was on BuzzFeed yesterday.
Yeah, he has apologized for behavior that he says happened when he was under the influence of alcohol and he was 26 years old against a male actor, a young man named Rapp, I guess is his last name. He's also been criticized because he's used the occasion of apologizing for this event to come out as gay. And there are a lot of people who are very upset about that because they're then equating molestation with homosexuality, which is, of course, not something that you have to equate. What's the blowback that you would anticipate, Jed, for an actor like Kevin Spacey, who also is a director, who's also producing things, and he's House of Cards and all these things?
Yeah, he's made a very strong stand all the way through to not talk about his sexuality, just to avoid that discussion. It's nobody's business, that kind of that feeling. I think in the actor world, I think we've sort of gotten beyond the Rock Hudson, you know, you can't possibly admit that you're gay. I don't think anybody cares anymore. I don't know all the data on this. I don't, you know.
But what about the fact that he evidently assaulted this young man, Anthony Rapp, when he was a very young kid?
I mean, I don't know the details. I think if it's a Harvey Weinstein kind of thing, I mean, I think then it will have real consequence and maybe others come out, all that. The other thing I wanted to say about, because I think there really is a change happening. We don't know, we're in the middle of it or at the beginning of it, but I've been so struck in the wake of the Harvey Weinstein and then Kobach and all the others that have come out, is women talking to each other instructively about handling this in the moment so that you, however you get handle this thing, you come out of it without humiliation and guilt and it was all my fault and what did I do wrong, and also strategically, you know, how you handle it vis-a-vis career. And it seems like we criticize the internet a lot for, you know, fake news and rumors and stuff like that. I think this is a case where that community that's coming together may really be doing some good on a very granular personal level.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll come back and we'll talk about some of the movies that are in theaters these days that we might want to check out. It's Halloween season and it's Oscar season and award season. So we will do that with Ann Hornaday. She is the film critic for The Washington Post. Jed Dietz, the founder and director of the Maryland Film Festival and the SNF Parkway. Again, more Midday at the Movies after this short break. If you have a favorite horror movie that you'd like to check out every Halloween, give us a call, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Before we take a break, it's our custom on Mondays here on Midday to read the names of the people who have fallen victim to violence in the previous week in Baltimore. We do so to acknowledge them, their families, and their friends who are grieving. So far this year, 295 people in Baltimore City have lost their lives to violence. They include a 29-year-old man whom police have yet to identify, as well as Thomas Chambers. He was 49 years old when he died in August from injuries that he sustained in a shooting back in 1990. Last week, the medical examiner ruled his death a homicide. In addition, four other people were the victims of homicide in Baltimore last week. They are Kendall LeCompte, age 27, Reggie Adams, age 25, Antoine Bond, age 26, and Elijah Johnson. He was 31 years old. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. And welcome Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. It's a special edition of Midday at the Movies. We're doing it here on a Monday instead of the first Thursday of the month. We're talking, as always, with Anne Hornaday, the film critic for The Washington Post, and Jed Dietz, the director of the Maryland Film Festival. If you've got a movie that you've seen that you really liked and you want to share with our listeners, give us a buzz, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. So I'd like to talk about a movie that, for once, I have seen.
Yes, it's a banner day.
Hallelujah. Longtime listeners to the program know that I have an incredibly pathetic life and never get out.
That's a very full life.
No, very full life, right. But full of beans, mostly. No. But so Linnell and I saw The Florida Project. Mm-hmm. And it's one of those movies I'm not sure whether I liked or not. Mm. I know I didn't dislike it,
okay.
But I'm not sure I am crazy about it. I'm so mixed about this. It's one of these things, but it certainly lingers in memory.
Mm.
So here's a movie about this little kid and her mother who are living in a hotel, a sort of pay-by-the-day hotel. They're very much down on their luck and in financial straits. And it's, you know, a sort of slice of life of their a few weeks that take place in the summer in Florida. So, Anne, what do you think of this movie? Tell me whether I like this movie or not, because I just don't know.
Comma, and why.
Yeah, right, exactly.
It's funny. I think I had a very similar reaction as you did, Tom. I happened to see it at Cannes this year, and it was a very weak year at Cannes. And this was actually a high point, because I do think that it's the director, Sean Baker, did a movie a few years ago called Tangerine. Mm-hmm. That he did entirely on his iPhone, about two trans.
So amazing.
It's an amazing movie, and it bursts with color and life and warmth and joy. And I think that he brings a lot of those same aesthetic values to this. It's a very colorful, you know, it's filmed in right next to Disney World in Florida. It's kind of American Dream adjacent. And so it's a real kind of metaphorical exploration of how far away the American dream is for some people, but they're sort of still living within its confines, with it sort of tantalizingly close. And I think just visually he expresses that really beautifully. I was not, though, this movie left me cold in a lot of ways, chief among which is that most of the cast is non-professional actors, especially the kids. And I think he over-directed them. I mean, they deliver these really over-the-top performances where I got the sense of him constantly saying, give me more, give me more, give me more. By contrast, Willem Dafoe is one of the few professional actors in the cast. He plays the manager of this place, sort of the den father, this kind of father figure to all these lost souls. And I thought his performance was absolutely beautiful. And so but it was distracting. It only underlined for me just how poorly these other folks were served by the director. So it didn't that did not work for me.
And when you see this movie, there are three or four kids, and one in particular who's the daughter of the mother. It's
right.
Those two are the main protagonists.
Right.
I mean, it's an amazing performance. It's a six-year-old kid, and maybe it is over the top, but it is kind of interesting to even be thinking about a six-year-old kid doing anything.
Remember,
I mean, your whole life is over the top when you're 6 years old.
Remember Beasts of the Southern Wild,
right?
I mean,
Kavan's in
early,
egg, yeah.
You're right, early Shirley Temple. I mean, there are kids who have done Tatum O'Neill, who've done extraordinary performances at a very young age. I think this milieu is, you know, the lower middle class or just above poverty level, or you know, that like Disney World adjacent world that Anne was describing, I think is a very important thing to be shown on film. I just think it's been done so much better by people like Andrea Arnold or Matt Porterfield, or people who are, you feel like you're sort of in a neighborhood that maybe you're not familiar with, and you're learning about it, and this it just seemed not to do that so much. It was visually stunning, and laugh out loud sometimes, visually stunning. And I thought some of the scenes worked, but I thought it was a collage of these scenes with not much behind it.
Yeah, there is, and I had the same, frankly, I've had the same problems with Andrea Arnold with her last movie, American Honey, and some of Matt Porterfield's work. There is a touch of voyeurism to these things that I think it's very difficult to overcome. And this movie suffers from that particularly. I did not find it authentic. You know, there were moments where it just felt so contrived and so confected.
It's interesting too. I mean, forgive me. I don't have the notes in front of me about who are starring in this movie. But the woman who plays the mother, she's also not an actor. And from what I understand, the director Sean Baker found her on Instagram.
Yeah, she's an Instagram star.
So what does that say about Hollywood and the pool of talent that's out there? I mean, it would seem to me that there are plenty of actresses who could, you know, bona fide actresses who've studied the art and craft of acting who could have played that role. I mean, did Mr. Baker really look that hard? I mean, it's interesting to me that they seem to go out of their way to hire non-professional talent.
I don't know. I think that...
What does that mean?
I can't answer for him, but I would imagine it could be... It seemed to me like it was a part of his whole aesthetic design for this movie to... I think this movie's all about those sorts of borders, you know, and that porous border between reality and dream and professional and non-professional. I mean, to me, it was of a piece with the enterprise of the movie.
And we've seen movies where, you know, people, Eddie Furlong was cast off the streets of San Francisco for Terminator. You know, I mean, it can work. And I think to answer the question about what's the director trying to do, I think this quest for authenticity, which I think in Sean Baker, totally sincere. I would argue Andrea Arnold and Matt Porterfield hit that note better. Yeah. But it's a very hard thing. It's a very tricky thing to do. And I think that's why you go looking for people on Instagram.
Yeah. Mm. I mean, even I have been approached about starring in a biopic, the Rosie O'Donnell story.
And there you go.
And they think this is just, you know, very unusual casting choice. You know, God bless them.
Is it fully financed yet, Tom?
I don't think so. But the green light is not a word that has been associated with this project yet. But we'll see what happens.
It's got the yellow light.
It's a yellow light project. Let's go to a Tom who's smarter than me. He's in Hagerstown, and he's on the phone. Welcome to Midday at the Movies, Tom. Thanks for your call.
Hello.
Hi, how you doing?
Glad to be on today. Hello to everybody.
Hi.
I just wanted to say that I was really disappointed that this is the first time I have heard anybody mention Wind River.
Oh.
It's already gone from the Hagerstown theaters, but it really needed to be discussed. It's beautifully photographed, beautifully written, beautifully acted, and a well-crafted story. It does have one or two little flaws, but nothing that distracts from it so terribly. I was particularly really blown away by the fact that it is a story that it takes place in a different location than we're used to, with totally different people. It tells us about a whole society thing that is very rarely mentioned, and it is just a beautifully done story.
Oh, well, that's good to bring that to our attention, Tom. I appreciate that. Wind River, Anne. Yeah. I mean, is it a good movie?
Oh, it was a wonderful movie.
Yeah,
and
it's
done by a guy named Tyler Sheridan, who had written Sicario and Hell or High Water, which was, if you enjoyed Wind River, you've got to see Hell or High Water. It's just fantastic. But this is his directorial debut. And I think he did a really fine job. I don't know if Tom had the same reservations I did about it. There were a few scenes toward the end that I thought were, they didn't work for me in terms of the tonal unity of the piece. But it's definitely Jeremy Renner's best performance since The Hurt Locker.
Yeah,
I mean, it's absolutely wonderful, to the point where I would love to see that character come back. I would love to see a series based on this guy because just like Tom said, the milieu, it takes place on the high prairie. I can't remember if it's Montana or Wyoming or Colorado, but it's just out in the American West. It's beautiful, and he's a really great character.
Well, that's a good one. I'm glad we could think about that one. Wind River. Bobby from Baltimore has sent us an email about the movies that he watches every Halloween. Ooh. So here are his three favorites. George Romero's original Night of the Living Dead.
Of course.
Sam Raimel's 80s Evil Dead 2. And then Sam Raimi's Drag Me to Hell from the mid-2000s. How does that happen? Drag Me to Hell, that's the name of a movie? Really?
Yeah, that was really controversial.
He says they're all beautifully shot, they're innovative, they're humorous, and they're full of sharp social commentary.
Okay.
I mean, do you write your mom? Dear mom, guess what? Great news. Just got cast in Drag Me to Hell. I mean, how does that work?
Well, so he has to get to the Parkway tonight because we've got George Romero's Crazies and then Toby Hooper Eaten Alive.
Okay, that's what's happening at the park. That's what you're doing for Halloween.
Right. And the Parkway, what a perfect place to see those.
Right.
That's going to be fun.
What does that mean?
Because it's got that wonderful, you know, like old theater romance to it. It's
okay.
Cool.
Okay, I just wanted
to be sure. I can totally see.
Just wanted to make sure you didn't think it was a horrific experience.
No. Okay. It's very evocative and moody and redolent of old cinema.
There you go. There's a new cinema that's happening at the Parkway, and this is a very interesting. From what I'm told, is a very interesting movie called Human Flow by the Chinese artist Ai Weiwei. So that's also at the Parkway, just open. What's that about, Jeff?
It's about the human flow of refugees around the world. 34,000 people a day become refugees. This is not a polemic. This is not a trained Ai Weiwei, incredible artist, not a trained filmmaker, and he's done something that great artists often do, which is to take a news event, or in this case, multiple news events from around the world, Afghanistan, Sudan, Syria, Palestine, etc., Mexico, and let you experience something about them that is beyond knowledge. You see the beauty of the surroundings. You see the beauty of the people who are actually on the ground doing something about it, trying to flee horror, and then people trying to accept them and help them to take the next step in their lives. I can't say enough about this movie. It's gorgeous to look at. It's funny in some cases and unbelievably emotional as you go through it in a great way, totally fascinating. And you learn, you think you know something, and you come out of it knowing so much more.
Yeah,
it's
amazing. You don't think of him as a filmmaker, but that's interesting. Mm-hmm. We just got a couple minutes left here, actually a minute left. And let me ask you about movies by Common and Brad Young. Brad Young is a cinematographer. He did Selma, Arrival. There's two movies called Letter to the Free and Black America. Again, these are sort of very much about Baltimore.
Definitely. They showed Black America again last night at the Washington West Film Festival in Reston. And Brad Young and Common were there, and a wonderful cinematographer named Hans Charles, who shot 13th, the Ava DuVernay documentary, led them in a really fantastic post-screening discussion. But it's kind of Brad and Common sort of collaborated. You know, it's a film inspired by Common's song, but it's not a music video. It's really a short film. Inspired by the song, by Freddie Gray, by the resilience of this city, by the youth of this city. It's an exquisitely filmed. I mean, Brad is, I think, the greatest image maker in our cinematic world today. And you just see all of his gifts.
And he lives here, right?
Yes, we're lucky to have him. Yeah. I'm not sure exactly. I think you can see them both on, I'm not sure exactly. I know they're streaming somewhere. I should have done my homework.
Well, folks can look them up.
But if you Google them, I think you can see
Letter to the Free and Black America Again.
Yeah.
All right, cinematographer Brad Young from right here in Baltimore. All right, well, thanks to you both. Good to see you, and we'll see you next month.
Thanks, Tom.
Ann Hornaday is the film critic for The Washington Post. Jed Dietz, the founder and director of the Maryland Film Festival. A reminder that coming up tomorrow on Midday, our guest here in Studio A will be Baltimore City Mayor Catherine Pugh. Hope you can join us. I'd like to thank the Diz for supplying lunch today. The Diz is located at 300 West 30th Street in the heart of Remington. They feature signature burgers, wings, steaks, and jumbo lump crab cakes. The Diz is open for lunch and dinner with breakfast served on the weekends. You can find them on the web at thedizbaltimore.com. I'm Tom Hall. Appreciate your listening. Have a good day.